Conciliation as Counterterrorist Strategy by Peter C. Sederberg, Department of Government and International Studies, University of South Carolina. This article appeared in the Journal of Peace Research, Volume 32, Number 3, 1995. Conventional wisdom suggests that regimes should never bargain with terrorists. This preference for coercive and repressive responses rests largely on rhetorical rather than analytical characterizations of the problem of terrorism. If we consider terrorism as one possible tactic available to a challenger group engaged in a political struggle, we push the question of response back into the political context where it belongs. We argue that two major models of this political context, the war model and the rational actor model, not only fail to preclude conciliatory strategies, they actually incorporate them. We outline some of the strategic and tactical considerations that must be weighed in determining the appropriateness of a conciliatory strategy. You don't make peace with friends, you make peace with enemies. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. 1. Introduction. The last few months of 1993 presented some contrasting responses to terrorism. In New York, those accused of the bombing of the World Trade Center began their trial. The prosecution and the media served up once again the powerful images of destruction and confusion resulting from this attack. The judicial proceedings reminded U.S. citizens how vulnerable they remain to terrorist attacks and emphasized the need for vigilant intelligence and vigorous law enforcement as the best lines of defense against small, determined groups of violent fanatics. Yet on a splendid autumn day in Washington, the Prime Minister of Israel shook hands with the chairman of the Palestine Liberation Organization after taking the first tentative step toward the reconciliation of their two bitterly divided peoples. Hardliners in Israel, led by Benjamin Netanyahu, warned of impending doom, but most Israelis seemed anxious to give peace a chance. Following shortly on these dramatic and unexpected events, word emerged that John Major's conservative government was exploring the possibility of a political settlement of the long-festering conflict in Northern Ireland with representatives of Sinn Féin, the political arm of the Irish Republican Army. Meanwhile, the de Klerk government and the African National Congress continued to develop plans to turn political power over to the black majority in South Africa. These events follow along after the negotiations of recent years that have ended long-standing civil conflicts in El Salvador and Nicaragua. In each of these cases, representatives of established regimes and challengers repeatedly condemned by these regimes as terrorists entered into negotiations clearly involving the prospect of political concessions. Unquestionably, the recent initiatives may come to a bitter end, as extremists on all sides recognize a clear threat to their political agendas and power. Nevertheless, something unusual and important is going on here. Some of its most avid advocates have abandoned their counter-terrorist policy of no retreat, no surrender, at least for a time. Unfortunately, the literature offers little sympathetic analysis of the prudence of conciliatory policies of negotiations and concessions. Indeed, usually commentators peremptorily condemn such policies as likely to lead to further terrorism. Conventional condemnations, however, fail to provide an adequate intellectual response to both the theory and practice of conciliation. Historically, regimes have repeatedly engaged in conciliation of one form or another with challenger groups using terrorism. Regime concessions have ranged from ransom payments for the release of hostages to formal political accommodations with their antagonists to bring about a cessation of hostilities. Yet a recent survey of Western response to terrorism provides little systematic analysis of the context and consequences of conciliatory efforts. Military and vigorous legal responses, in contrast, receive a thorough analysis detailing the shortcomings and risks, as well as the promise of these common counter-terrorist strategies. Part of the reason for the inadequate discussion of conciliatory alternatives arises from inadequacies of definition and perception. Consequently, we must first attempt to clarify the context of our discussion by briefly characterizing the nature of terrorism and the problem of response. We concentrate on challenger terrorism, although some observations also address the problem of regime terrorism. We then examine two common theoretical models upon which discussions of response commonly draw, at least implicitly, the war model and the rational actor model. Each of these can justify vigorous repressive responses, but each also suggests conditions for conciliatory policies. Finally, we attempt to identify some of the factors affecting the success of conciliation as a counterterrorist strategy. 2. Clarifying the context for discussion. One unfortunate necessity in discussions of terrorism is the need to return to fundamental conceptual distinctions. Discussion of the problem continues to be clouded by ambiguity to such an extent that all commentators must clarify where they stand on points of definition and perception. 2.1. Hating the sin, loving the sinner. Confusion starts with the language chosen to depict the problem. Who wants to defend granting concessions to terrorists? Explicitly, the word flattens our perception of people acting in outrageous ways. They are terrorists, slayers of the innocent, pure and simple. Implicitly, the term encourages us to think in a neutered present, focusing on specific actors, ignoring both past and future in any detailed sense. In Christopher Hitchens' words, the label disguises reality and impoverishes language, and makes a banality out of the discussion of war and revolution and politics. Simply shifting the rhetoric to the discussion of terrorism, the act, in distinction to terrorist, the actor, helps to clarify the problem. Now the issue becomes whether one should ever follow conciliatory strategies toward groups that have engaged in terrorism. This simple word change explicitly separates the act from the actor and suggests the need to judge the act in some wider context. Since almost every regime and radical challenger group has some acts of terrorism to their credit or discredit, we are encouraged to make distinctions on other grounds. Once our attention shifts from the actor to the act, we can more easily place terrorist tactics in some perspective. Of course, we do not wish to underestimate the damage done by terrorism, particularly that undertaken by the state or challengers that approach state-like capabilities, nor do we wish to discount the nightmare that a weak and desperate challenger might someday use weapons of mass destruction. Nevertheless, a focus on terrorism as a tactic increases the possibility of more accurate assessment of its significance. 2.2. Recognizing the sin when we see it. Debates over the definition of terrorism may be a form of intellectual onanism, enjoyable but not especially fruitful. Nevertheless, we must come to some conclusion about the best way to distinguish terrorist tactics from other coercive instruments used in a political struggle. A variety of problems impede our efforts to develop an analytically useful definition of terrorism. First, an understandable but confusing tendency to intermingle explanation, justification, and condemnation mars many definitions. Second, the confusion between the action, terrorism, the actor, the terrorist, and the effect, terror, detracts from our ability to distinguish between terrorism and the larger class of coercive action of which it is a part. In this regard, definitions should focus on the act and recognize that issues of actors and facts are areas for inquiry, not definitional attributes. Finally, the option of focusing on various subspecies of terrorism, for example, skyjacking, fails to specify what it is about these subspecies that makes them terrorist. Though we may be able to formulate some policy response to particular activities, we would be forced to abandon the search for a more general understanding. If we are to rescue the concept of terrorism from the polemicists, as well as address the concerns of those who believe it to be an empty category, we must specify those characteristics that distinguish terrorism from other coercive tactics used within or between political communities. Two traits, each drawing upon fairly well-established rules of war, seem to hold some promise. The most well-established limits on the conduct of warfare involve the targets selected and the means chosen to attack those targets. Specifically, the targets of attack should be combatants, and the weapons used against these targets should be highly discriminating. The principle of non-combatant immunity and the ban on indiscriminate means are certainly interrelated. Nevertheless, they raise distinct issues. Terrorism may be seen as a tactic of severe coercion that deliberately violates these two rules of war. Terrorism deliberately targets non-combatants and uses indiscriminate means. These criteria, then, suggest two propositions and two qualifying exceptions. Proposition 1. Discriminating acts of coercion aimed at combatants are not terrorist. Exception 1. At some point, attacks on combatants may become so indiscriminate, counterforce nuclear war, that they become terrorist in effect, if not intent. Proposition 2. Indiscriminating and severe coercive attacks deliberately aimed at non-combatants are terrorist. Exception 2. At some point, attacks against non-combatants may become so discriminating in choice of target, for example, a tyrant, and means, that they are not usefully labeled terrorist. The value of this definition lies both in its clear specification of what tactics are or are not terrorist, and in its explicit identification of the areas where disputes are likely to arise. In other words, indiscriminate attacks on presumed combatants, highly discriminating attacks on non-combatants. Moreover, by treating terrorism as a tactic, this approach tacitly recognizes that all contenders in a political struggle may yield to the terrorist temptation. Two key questions, however, remain open. Who is a non-combatant? And how indiscriminate is too indiscriminate? These probably cannot be convincingly resolved by definitional fiat. Although they remain open to debate, provisional determinations need not be arbitrary, but should be supported by reasoned elaboration. The characteristics we have suggested for distinguishing terrorism from other coercive tactics, however, suggest why terrorism commonly spreads fear far in excess of the concrete damage done or the probabilities of being a victim. The distinction between combatants and non-combatants is, perhaps, the last firebreak of a civil order. Once breached, no one can feel secure. Terrorism, moreover, often involves innocuous targets, such as airplanes, railway depots, and department stores, places that people normally consider safe. Terrorist acts cause not only substantive damage, but also they undermine the confidence people have in the familiar. Now every place must be viewed with suspicion, if not alarm. If we abandon the concept of terrorism to the ideologues, or ignore the differences between terrorism and other forms of coercion, we hamper the possibilities for successful political action to contain this particular tactic. Only if we have a sensible and reasonably clear idea of the distinctive traits of terrorism can we pursue questions of who uses it and why, and what we should do about it. 2.3. The problem of responding to sin. Attachment to a particular line of response obscures the range of policies actually available and discourages a more thorough analysis of what might be appropriate and when. These options, varying from extreme repression to systematic conciliation, arise not from a definitive single theory of counterterrorism so much as reactions to different situations and opportunities. The absence of any encompassing theory of terrorism, after all, should lead us to expect similar diversity when it comes to policies to combat it. One theme in the literature of response agonizes over the particular vulnerability of democracies to dissident terrorism, as well as their institutional incapability of responding effectively against it. Relatively open societies present more opportunities for attack. Open borders facilitate the travel of radicals and their weapons. And the commitment to the rule of law restricts the police, but has no effect on those willing to use terrorism. Finally, the free media amplify the effects of terrorism and thereby unwittingly serves the perpetrator's agenda. Critics contend that the USA supports establishment counterterrorist campaigns around the world and, moreover, manipulates the media at home to support such policies. Dror qualifies his discussion of the problems terrorism poses for democracies by arguing that weak democracies are the most vulnerable. We should take his point one step further. Weak states, whether fragile democracies or tenuously supported autocracies, are the most vulnerable to terrorism. Not only will dissident groups find the space to operate in a weak state, but such regimes will more likely succumb to the temptation of establishment terrorism, whether private or official, when confronting widespread dissent. The most fundamental prescription for preventing terrorism of all kinds recommends strengthening the institutional support of the state. Democracies have demonstrated that relative openness, representativeness, responsiveness, and commitment to the rule of law generally prove superior to authoritarian prescriptions for institutional development. Judgments about appropriate response to terrorism, then, often reflect two criteria: acceptability to our democratic sensibilities, and effectiveness in minimizing the problem. Superficially, these criteria might seem reasonably clear and the problem straightforward. A specifically effective response might not be acceptable, for example, turning the country into a police state, and acceptable response might not be effective, for example, providing those accused of terrorism the full protection of a democratic system of legal rights. How then can we find effective solutions that do not damage our democratic values and institutions? Several factors further complicate the problem of choice. First, this characterization encourages the view that the problem of response represents one of simple trade-offs. That is, increasing effectiveness necessarily comes at the price of declining acceptability. We tend to underestimate the possibility that the democratic principles themselves may suggest effective response. Negotiation, compromise, and conciliation rest at the heart of democratic political processes, but commentators usually dismiss them as irrelevant or even dangerously ineffective. Second, an inclination to overvalue the effectiveness of repression reinforces the tendency to dismiss the efficacy of conciliatory responses. Both policymakers and analysts alike seem to feel that a little vigorous repression would go a long way to addressing the problem of terrorism, but grudgingly admit, echoing Richard Nixon, that it would be wrong. More thoughtful analysts, however, recognize that external military action or internal police repression may not only damage democratic principles and processes, but also they may fail to lessen the problem of terrorism and could even inflame it further. In any case, negotiation and conciliation must be judged not against some idealized strategy of perfect repression, but against what occurs in the real world. Third, the introduction of notions of time further complicates judgments about effectiveness. What works over the short run may not work over the longer term, and vice versa. A reiterated game differs substantially from one conceived as a single round of play. Interestingly, those who argue against short-term concessions often make the point that though immediately effective in ending a particular terrorist event, concessions only encourage the perpetrators and other interested parties to engage in more terrorism in the future. Consequently, sooner or later, the regime will have to engage in repression or face an escalating terrorist challenge. Less recognized is the possibility that repression too may only work in the short term, and sooner or later the regime will have to undertake conciliation or risk becoming a permanent garrison state. These variations suggest the possibility of pursuing strategies that mix repression and conciliation. 2.4. Restating the problem. Given the range of potential response, the complicating factors of time, and the possibility for mixed strategies, we need to clarify the focus of our analysis. We are not primarily concerned with the use or wisdom of negotiations and concessions as a short-term tactic to manage an immediate terrorist event. Almost everyone recognizes the utility of negotiations in a hostage situation, if only to buy time and wait the hostage takers out. Debate continues, however, over the prudence of tactical concessions, such as the publication of political manifestos, the release of prisoners, or the paying of ransoms, to end a terrorist action. Tactical negotiations and concessions, however, interest us only insofar as they comprise part of a more comprehensive conciliatory strategy to reduce or eliminate the use of terrorism in an extended political contest. Although a counterterrorist strategy may combine conciliatory and repressive elements, we focus on the potential contribution of the conciliatory components to the successful elimination of terrorism. In this regard, Martha Crenshaw observes that terrorism declines because of three factors: physical defeat of the extremist organization by the government, the group's decision to abandon the terrorist strategy, and organizational disintegration. Successful repression, of course, makes the primary contribution to the direct physical destruction of a political challenger, but repression cannot always succeed at an acceptable or at any cost. Counter-terrorist strategy could also contribute to the other two causes for a declining incidence of terrorism: the explicit decision to abandon terrorist tactics, or the unplanned disintegration of the challenger group using terrorism. We explore why and how conciliation might contribute to a strategy aimed at either encouraging the abandonment of terrorist tactics or the disintegration of the group using such tactics. Unfortunately, a strategy aimed at facilitating the political transformation of the challenger pursues goals somewhat contrary to those of a strategy intended to induce disintegration. We must recognize, however, that other elements, both repressive and serendipitous, may also contribute to a challenger's transformation or disintegration, including the loss of an external patron or internal political rivalries. Conciliatory policies, however, may also enhance the effectiveness of repression, encourage abandonment by external patrons, and reinforce personal rivalries within the challenger group. 3. Models of terrorism and conciliatory responses. Krellenstein and Schmid note that initial conceptions of the problem of terrorism influence the pattern of response chosen. Thus, the view that terrorism is war leads its proponents to favor repressive responses. The view that terrorism is crime leads its proponents to favor legal solutions. And the view that terrorism is a desperate cry for help leads its proponents to favor therapeutic remedies. They make a valid point, but we might benefit from a closer look at what two major models or theories of terrorism appearing to favor repressive strategies actually suggest about the possible role of conciliatory responses. 3.1. The war model. Conventional wisdom suggests that viewing terrorism as war justifies, for better or worse, a repressive military response. Critics argue that the war model inflates the significance of most terrorist threats to national survival, gives groups using terrorism standing as military antagonists that they do not merit, and exaggerates the efficacy of military response to terrorist acts. These misgivings have merit, but they focus too narrowly on the tactical implications of the war model. We might do well to recall some of the strategic and political entailments of the model as well. Somewhat simplistically, wars may be either limited or unlimited. Unlimited wars tend to subvert the Clausewitzian principle of the politically instrumental war, for they seek the total destruction of the adversary by whatever means available. In pre-modern times, an unlimited war might still confront practical limitations in that, though they possessed the will, the contestants lacked the means to achieve their unlimited goals. In our time, we can more effectively pursue unlimited objectives should we so choose. Alternatively, war may be conceived as a limited instrument to achieve limited goals. The concept of limited war grows in significance as the consequences of unlimited war threaten to dwarf any meaningful political end. Ian Clark notes that the concept of limited war involves two distinct but interrelated problems: how to resolve the conflict while limiting its impact, and how to limit the impact of the conflict while working to resolve it. Limited impact and limited duration depend on one another, because if destruction is unlimited, then termination becomes moot. If duration is unlimited, limits on impact become moot. The overheated rhetoric of the war model of terrorism, of course, often characterizes these conflicts in unlimited terms. The challengers presumably seek the total destruction of the state, and the state seeks the total elimination of their antagonists. This rhetoric, though, often defies reality. Undoubtedly, some groups possess totalistic or nihilistic goals, more on this below, but not all the groups using terrorism have unlimited political agendas. Ethnic conflicts fuel much of the terrorism of the world, both internal and transnational. These ethnic groups, whether Sikh, Basque, Northern Irish, or Tamil, usually do not seek the utter destruction of their adversaries in the regime. Their aims, while hardly benign, are not unlimited. Moreover, most groups who resort to terrorism do not generate the levels of destruction of which they seem theoretically capable. Completely gratuitous destruction would likely prove damaging to their own political agendas. Even a revolutionary group that seeks the overthrow of the regime, not merely independence from it, has an interest in containing the level of destruction. After all, someday they hope to inherit the body politic. They benefit little if it's a corpse. Regimes seem more likely to embrace unlimited objectives, a tendency reflected in the magnitude of the body counts attributable to regime terrorism. Challenger groups, as J. Boyer Bell observes, have had neither the capacity nor the desire to kill great masses. Only rulers have had both. Nevertheless, many regimes, particularly democratic ones, have been reluctant to use all the weapons at their disposal to extirpate challenger groups, soil, root, and branch. Again, practical considerations about the self-destructive costs of an unlimited campaign of repression figure greatly in regime restraint. Regimes, too, may seek some accommodation or reconciliation, at least with those who provide support and sympathy for the challenger groups engaged in terrorism. Once contenders in a war acknowledge that they fight for limited objectives with limited means, they also tacitly accept that the conflict will end through a political process involving some form of accommodation. Such a process will characterize even those conflicts possessing a clear victor, as long as victory is not total and defeat is not utter. The political process terminating a limited war necessarily entails negotiations which, by their nature, involve the mutual recognition of the adversary's legitimacy. The acceptance of the conflict's limited objectives and the necessity for a process of war termination ultimately leads to something more than the vague recognition of the opponent's right to exist. Since the adversaries will ultimately become negotiating partners, each gains a vested interest in both the survival and the capability of the other. Neither side wishes to see their tacit partner completely destroyed, either through tactical military operations or as a result of internal rivalries. Each partner, moreover, hopes, indeed requires, that the other side can enforce any mutual agreements on their own members. In short, neither side in a conflict of limited duration and objective has an interest in destroying the other side's command or control. Limited war, ironically, ultimately leads to a kind of implicit interdependence between the antagonists. The recent negotiations between the Israeli government and the PLO illustrate these tendencies and implications. Even more ironic, appeasement becomes the opposite side of limited warfare as a coin of statecraft. Edward Luttwak observes that the purpose of appeasement, properly understood, is to uncover the incentives to war and to offer, if possible, such benefits as would outmatch their attraction, while advertising with due discretion the disincentives as well. Limited wars for limited objectives, then, are fought with an eye to costs. If the costs of the military solution grow too high, then appeasement might offer the better bargain. These two forms of inducement, Luttwak carefully notes, reinforce rather than undercut one another. Without the willingness to appease, wars become endless. Without the willingness to fight, concessions become continuous. Embracing the war model, then, does not automatically preclude the possibility, or even the desirability, of a conciliatory strategy. Only if the war against terrorism is construed in totalistic terms would such a rejection be warranted. If the war analogy incorporates limited war concepts, then negotiations and concessions come along as part of the political package of war termination. The question whether a particular conflict involving terrorism is best seen as a limited war remains an empirical and political issue, not one resolved by definitional fiat. 3.2. The Rational Actor Model. If the war model does not preclude the possibility of conciliation, the rational actor model suggests some particulars of conciliation as a counter-terrorist strategy. Such an assertion may seem absurd, since proponents of repressive response strategies often draw on rational-like arguments to make their case. Typically, arguments for repression rely on two loosely construed and somewhat interrelated rationality arguments involving deterrence and demonstration effects. The first argument assumes that whatever their other psychological attributes, those resorting to terrorism possess adequate rationality to calculate costs and benefits. If the regime, therefore, can raise the cost to a sufficient level of severity and certainty, they will deter challengers from employing terrorism. The second argument suggests that if regimes reward terrorist acts in any way, those using or contemplating terrorism will calculate the benefits of such tactics as rising, and this calculation will increase their likelihood of using terrorism in the future. Those making such arguments seldom reflect on the assumptions of the rationality thesis or the difficulties attendant on its use. Our purpose, however, is not to offer another skeptical reading of the rational actor model, but to explore its implications for a strategy of concessions. Clearly, if we assume that those using terrorism are completely irrational, then we have little reason to have confidence in either strategy of conciliation, short of conversion, or repression, short of extermination. In addition, more systematic efforts to exploit the rational actor model yield interesting implications for bargaining in a hostage situation, the displacement effects of various counter-terrorist programs, and optimal counter-terrorist policies. Most of us like to think of ourselves as rational, but rational choice theory starts with a relatively restricted characterization of rationality. Michael Taylor, for example, identifies three major features of what he terms the thin theory of rationality. 1. Rationality is relative to given attitudes and beliefs, which are each assumed to be consistent, and the agent's actions are instrumental in achieving or advancing the given aims in light of the given beliefs. 2. The agent is assumed to be egoistic. 3. In applications of thin theory, the range of incentives assumed to affect the agent is limited. In order for the actions to produce optimal outcomes, the agent must possess perfect information about the costs and benefits of alternative choices. In particular, the agent must be capable of comparing cost and benefits according to some common standard. Notice as well that the second feature eliminates the possibility of some kind of altruistic identification with a larger collectivity that would lead to rational self-sacrifice. Incentives are limited to the public good being sought, the resources the actors devote to the pursuit of the public good, and a limited range of reasonably concrete selective incentives. Incentives, that is, accruing to specific actors depending on the course of action they choose. A simple theory of rational deterrence of terrorism begins with two rational actors, the regime and the challenger. Note, these are assumed to be unitary actors. This simplifying assumption, common to both deterrence theory and the realist perspective underlying the war model, obscures problems and opportunities identified later. The challenger moves first, attacking the regime or not, and the regime chooses whether to retaliate or not. If the challenger perceives the regime's threat to retaliate as credible, that is, the challenger believes that the regime possesses both the will and the means to carry out the threat, then the challenger will be deterred if the threatened retaliation outweighs the anticipated benefits of the attack. Successful deterrence depends, therefore, on both the severity of the threat and its credibility. If the presumed benefits of the attack outweigh the threatened costs, then credibility will have little impact. If the threats have little credibility, then their severity will have little deterrent effect. The problem of credibility produces the nagging suspicion that deterrent threats should periodically fail so that those making them can demonstrate they possess the will and the means to retaliate. Defenders of rational deterrent theory argue that periodical failures only demonstrate that the deterrent has failed, not that the theory has failed. Indeed, the theory predicts periodic failures. Critics of rational deterrent theory, of course, develop more direct attacks on the validity of the rational actor assumptions. Our interest, however, lies in exploring the implications of the rational actor assumptions for a strategy of conciliation rather than repression. Lebeau and Stein observe that traditional deterrence theory, though focusing narrowly on the use of threats, actually incorporates the more general expectation that variation in outcomes can be explained by differences in the actor's opportunities. Calculation of opportunities, however, includes more than the estimation of the potential benefits of attack balanced against the potential costs of retaliation. They also logically include calculations of the benefits of not attacking, weighted against the costs of inaction. Presumably, if the net profit of the latter course outweighs that of the former, the rational challenger will not attack. In short, rational deterrence works by either, or both, increasing the rewards of inaction or the costs of attack. The issue of credibility, of course, influences how the challenger estimates both the promise of reward as well as the threat of punishment. In addition, Lebeau and Stein observe that those who emphasize the threat side of the deterrent equation tend to assume that the challengers are risk-prone gain maximizers. This assumption ignores three other logical possibilities. Initiators could also be risk-prone loss minimizers, risk-averse gain maximizers, and risk-averse loss minimizers. Deterrence by threat may not work very effectively against risk-prone loss minimizers, Japan's leaders in 1941 or Sadat in 1973, and may even be seen as provocative. The promise of rewards, in contrast, might prove quite attractive to the risk-averse challenger, especially the gain maximizer. The loss minimizer would seem highly susceptible to a mixed strategy of rewards and punishments. Not every actor, Lebowenstein note, is an Adolf Hitler. Those emphasizing the presumed efficacy of deterrent threats often assume all terrorist challengers are in fact little Hitlers, who will only be emboldened by anything that smacks of appeasement. This assertion, though, is an empirical hypothesis, subject to verification, and not an inherent trait of all groups resorting to terrorism. Rational deterrence theory does not preclude conciliation strategies. In fact, it identifies the types of rational actor that appear responsive to the promises of conciliation. Moreover, actors change. Egypt under Sadat went from sponsoring terrorism and making war against Israel to the first, and for 15 years only, country to make peace with her. The opportunity to regain lost territory and receive massive U.S. aid probably played at least as much a role in Sadat's calculations as the recognition of Israeli retaliatory capability. Rational deterrence is not the only aspect of rational actor theory that supports a possible role for concessions in counter-terrorist policy. The conventional rhetoric of terrorist analysis emphasizes the vulnerability of relatively open Western societies. The presumption of vulnerability, however, begs a rather serious question. Why are there so few terrorist attacks? Presumably it cannot be for lack of opportunity, nor for lack of discontented extremist groups. We might take the relative infrequency of terrorism as evidence for the effectiveness of Western deterrent policies. But most advocates of hardline repression commonly criticize Western policy as often vacillating and even ineffective. Collective action theory offers another explanation. Neither the challenger nor the regime is in reality a unitary actor. Rather, they are collective actors. Consequently, challenger groups contemplating terrorist or any other risky tactics confront a fairly severe free rider problem. Consider the position of thinly rational potential supporters of a challenger movement. They desire the objective pursued by the movement, the New Revolutionary Order, NRO, a public good. The NRO is a public good because it cannot be selectively allocated. That is, when the new order comes, all members of the society will enjoy its benefits. If anyone in a community receives a public good, everyone must receive it. This requirement is commonly termed non-excludability. We also assume that each individual's participation in the movement makes only a negligible contribution to the eventual outcome. Potential members of the challenger group then face quite a dilemma. Although they value the public good, their individual contributions make no noticeable difference on the probability of its achievement. In addition, they will share in the NRO regardless of whether or not they participate. However, their participation in risky challenger activities like terrorism involves some significant selective costs. At the very least, they absorb considerable direct and opportunity costs, the other goods they sacrifice by devoting their limited resources to the movement. At the worst, they could get killed. As rational egoists, these potential supporters will sit out the movement, even though they strongly value its promised public good. They will rationally choose to become free riders on other people's sacrifices. If we assume that all the potential participants in the challenger movement make a similar calculation, then a tragic result follows. Tragic, that is, for the challenger movement. Everyone free rides, and the movement fails. Even more tragic, since we assumed that our actors possess perfect information, they know the universal decision to free ride will produce this result. Yet they still defect from the movement, at least if any person's decision to participate is a one-time event, made without any interaction with other potential revolutionaries. It might seem that all potential supporters would recognize that their enlightened self-interest dictates that they should elect to participate. But if anyone thinks that the others will choose to participate, the greater incentive he or she has to defect and free ride. Moreover, since everyone thinks the same way, if anyone elects to participate, the participant knows that the others will free ride at her expense, making her a sucker. This would produce the worst possible outcome for her, a failed revolution plus her payment of all the selective costs of participation. Mark Leekbach refers to this situation as the rebel's dilemma. Rational potential rebels will choose to free ride, But if they do, the potential revolution will never become an actual revolution, since no potential revolutionary would ever rationally choose to become an actual revolutionary. Moreover, the passivity of the rational rebels is independent of both their feelings of relative deprivation and the value, however high, they place on the NRO. Even if frustrated and profoundly alienated, rational actors will still not rebel under these conditions. The free rider problem offers a rather persuasive explanation why relatively few people choose to attack the state through terrorist or any other risky means. Nonetheless, such attacks do occur, even if fairly infrequently. One possible explanation for these attacks is that the perpetrators are not rational. Of course, if they are irrational, then neither deterrent threats nor concessions will work to dissuade them. Leekbach identifies a number of ways through which Challenger Group might attempt to solve their free rider problem. The possible options include increased selective benefits, lower selective costs, increase the chances of making a difference to the outcome, increase risk-taking, manipulate incomplete information, build a bandwagon, increase mutual expectations, increase mutual exchange, overcome pecuniary self-interest, that is, change people from thinly rational egoists into something else, use tit-for-tat to learn not to defect, a standard solution to the prisoner's dilemma, locate revolutionary entrepreneurs, locate patrons, reorganize, impose and monitor agreements, and more. Most of these Leekbach notes beg the question of origin, that is, where do the resources to provide selective benefits or punishments come from? Why should patrons support a movement? How does an organization to monitor defection overcome its own free rider problem? And so on. The regime, which as a collective actor faces its own free rider problem, can work to reverse every one of these strategies in the hopes of either increasing defections and undermining organizational coherence, or encouraging the transformation of the Challenger Group's agenda. While repression clearly plays a role in increasing the selective costs of participation in radical actions, other more conciliatory tactics could reward defection and even start a reverse bandwagon effect. Mark Granovetter argues that participation in protest or riot depends on how many others are participating. He argues that people have different thresholds in this regard. That is, the more risk-averse potential participants need higher levels of pre-existing participation before they will throw their weight into the action. Put simply, they want safety in numbers. The reverse logic suggests that each defection increases the pressure on those remaining to defect as well. Conciliatory strategies can contribute to such calculations through amnesty programs for the followers and offers of legitimate participation for the leaders of challenger groups. Over the long run, Leekbach observes, collective action theory suggests that radical groups will become de-radicalized if regimes buy off followers and co-opt leaders. Conciliation, indeed, offers more promise, perhaps, when pursuing the corruption of radical challengers than do strategies of repression. 4. The strategy and tactics of conciliation as counter-terrorist policy. Two basic models of challenger terrorism, then, do not preclude conciliation as a counter-terrorist strategy. Indeed, models of terrorism that reject conciliation under any circumstances, for example, those conceiving terrorism as a tool of psychotics or unyielding fanatics resistant to compromise, also raise serious questions about the efficacy of repression short of extermination. Once we conclude that the challenger is either crazy or functions according to bizarre beliefs, like in salvation through suicide attacks, then repressive coercion will not produce its expected deterrent effects. Though conciliation cannot be dismissed out of hand, we must still determine when and how it might work. As J. Boyer Bell admonishes, we need to know thy terrorist, advice, he admits, more easily offered than followed. Each challenger group possesses its own political history and character that should shape regime response to it. They seldom embody perfect cohesion. Extremist rhetoric on both sides may obscure possibilities for accommodation. Moreover, groups change. Finally, repression and conciliation are not necessarily mutually exclusive counter-terrorist tactics. Indeed, conciliatory carrots often depend on the threat of repressive sticks. Regimes, of course, seek more useful guidance than the admonition that each case is unique. Consequently, we offer some preliminary thoughts on the general conditions and particular factors affecting the decision to pursue some form of conciliation. 4.1. General conditions for conciliatory success. Negotiations and short-term concessions, as we noted earlier, have often played a role in ending a particular terrorist incident. Critics view such short-term forms of conciliation with considerable suspicion, fearing that they only reward terrorism. The longer-term effects of short-term concessions, however, are difficult to predict with any confidence because other factors come into play. Initially, for example, airline hijackings paid off handsomely in terms of publicity and occasionally ransoms. Yet, whatever encouragement potential hijackers received from these early successes was soon reduced by enhanced airline security measures and international accords to punish air piracy. These increased security measures, however, did not so much end terrorist attacks as displace them onto softer targets. Once again, if we assume that potential users of terrorism are rational, then we must also accept that their expected short-term gains can be offset by an increase in expected short-term costs. And increased costs of one type of activity will encourage challengers to seek outlets with better payoffs. If nonviolent channels appear more promising, then rational challengers might forego terrorism altogether. More substantive long-term concessions may contribute to either the transformation or the disintegration of the challenger. Both the war and the deterrence models suggest the possibility of using conciliation to moderate a challenger group sufficiently so that it abandons terrorist tactics. Collective action theory suggests the further possibility of using conciliation to encourage the disintegration of the challenger group altogether, so that it cannot mount a terrorist or any other challenge to the regime. The task of devising a particular conciliatory strategy is complicated by these somewhat incompatible goals. One way regimes transform the behavior of the challenger is to withdraw from the field of contention. Now, this course of action may not seem to have much to recommend it, smacking as it does of surrender. But as the limited war model suggests, limited surrender, or more kindly, strategic withdrawal, may be the most practical, most ethical, and least costly way of proceeding. Historically, European colonial powers ultimately followed a policy of withdrawal as a way of terminating the conflicts in their colonies. These withdrawals were commonly negotiated, as in Palestine, Algeria, and Kenya, with adversaries previously condemned as terrorists. Certainly, to argue that the Europeans should have continued to fight on for their empires lest they reward terrorism is politically naive at best. Not many challengers can be so accommodated. Sometimes a regime cannot destroy the challenger, nor can it withdraw from the contest at an acceptable cost. The regime might then use concessions to encourage the challenger to abandon terrorism and other destructive tactics and develop into a more conventional contender for political power within the system. This goal implies that the conflict will not be terminated so much as regulated within conventionally established boundaries. Successful conflict regulation requires both parties to accept certain conditions. First, the contenders must recognize the necessity of each other's existence and their inevitable conflict of interest. As long as one or both parties continue to seek the destruction or conversion of their opponents, conflict regulation remains impossible. Indeed, the refusal of the regime to acknowledge the challenger often serves to drive the latter to increasingly extreme attacks. Alternatively, a challenger who seeks the utter destruction of the regime discourages conciliatory response from that regime. The contenders, therefore, must each concede that they cannot make the other side disappear, nor convert it, nor destroy it. Consequently, they must live together in some mutually acceptable arrangement. Although this concession might seem difficult to make after a bitter struggle, we might expect that an accommodative strategy will become more plausible the longer a violent stalemate continues. For conflict regulation to succeed, regimes must first accept previously castigated terrorists as negotiating partners. Second, once each side concedes the other's right to exist, then each must be represented by cohesive organizations in a context of mutual toleration. Sometimes regimes, in their effort to find acceptable negotiating partners, seek out parties that have limited support in the aggrieved community. Failure to deal with representatives of the real challenger, though, means that any agreements struck will not likely stick. For decades, the white regime in South Africa sought substitutes for having to deal with the ANC. Ultimately, the regime reluctantly acceded to the necessity of dealing with the ANC and lifted its ban on the organization. Once accepted, each negotiating partner then acquires a strong interest in the effectiveness of the other side. Successful conflict regulation cannot occur unless the parties to the agreement can enforce it on their respective members. Internal resistance to accommodation with the enemy, of course, belies the unitary actor assumptions common to both the war and the rational actor models. In the real world, intra-group tensions may increase as a result of inter-group accommodation. See the discussion of tactical factors below. Third, the contenders must agree on certain rules and norms, formal and informal, that provide the guidelines for the limited expression of their conflict, particularly with respect to allowable forms of coercion. These rules and norms also provide for processes through which the contenders can conduct their affairs and reach provisional accommodations. If a regime is unwilling or unable to transform a violent challenger into an acceptable participant in the established political process, then it could use concessions to promote the disintegration of its adversary. Like transformation, disintegration probably results from a mix of repressive and conciliatory policies. Here again, we focus on how concessions could contribute to division. One critical decision involves determining who to divide from whom. Studies of dissident movements commonly distinguish among various levels of participation in challenger activities. Somewhat summarily, we might divide the population into those opposed to the challenger movement, those sympathetic to it, and those generally indifferent. We may further divide the sympathizers into active or passive supporters, active supporters into the occasional or continuous participants. Finally, the continuous participants, the vanguard in Lenin's terms, into leaders or followers. Somewhat paradoxically, opportunities to pursue disintegrative strategies appear to increase as the support for the challenger group grows. An isolated fanatical cell of political dissidents offers few opportunities to use concessions to divide and conquer, and in any case, such fanatics would likely prove highly resistant to conciliatory appeals. They are more likely to approximate, in fact, the unitary actor assumptions of much strategic theory. In contrast, as support for the challenger group increases, so also do opportunities for the regime to exploit weak points in the linkages among the various levels of support. Concessions may be used to prevent the indifferent sector from growing sympathetic to the aims of the challengers. Concessions may also encourage passive supporters to defect from the challenger movement and become indifferent, or even supporters of the regime. These types of concessions, we should note, attempt to address the underlying causes of discontent rather than the specific program of the challenger organization or the specific demands made during a terrorist event. As we noted above, amnesty programs and other incentives may foster the defection of some activists. Finally, regime recognition of more moderate leadership of a challenger group may spur them to defect from their more radical compatriots. The possibility of using positive incentives to encourage the defection of more moderate activists and leaders suggests that the two goals of conciliatory strategy, transformation and disintegration, may be empirically combined, even though they appear logically incompatible. The combined strategic objective involves transforming the more moderate leadership while promoting the isolation and disintegration of the remaining extremist faction. A purely repressive strategy aimed at destroying the challenger leadership cadre may well eliminate precisely those moderates most susceptible to conciliatory appeals. Finally, we should take note of another potential linkage, that between a challenger organization and an external patron. As with other aspects of terrorism, the discussion of sponsorship often fails to make critical distinctions. The most important distinction for our purposes concerns the relative autonomy of the sponsored challenger. External patronage ranges from symbolic support to total control. The greater the external dependency of the challenger, the more important will be the relation of the regime to the external patron. A policy that separates a patron from its highly dependent client may contribute to the loss of that client's ability to attack its regime adversary. Again, coercive threats and attacks are often touted as the most effective means of quelling externally sponsored terrorism. Conciliatory efforts, though, may also prove effective. Improving political relations between the USA and the Soviet Union, and subsequently Russia, as well as between the USA and Syria, were probably more effective in weakening Soviet and Syrian sponsorship of groups using terrorism than the preceding years of militaristic threats. 4.2. Tactical factors affecting the success of conciliatory strategies. A number of factors affect the choice of a conciliatory counter-terrorist policy in general, as well as whether the particular goal of the strategy should be the transformation or disintegration of the challenger. These factors suggest a number of propositions concerning the chances for the success of a conciliatory strategy. 1. The relative representativeness of the challenger group. Punitive actions may be the most plausible option against isolated fringe groups, but a movement with a broad base of even passive support presents a very different problem to the regime. Repression directed against a widely supported challenger group may only solidify or even expand their support. Unfortunately, as the Palestinian and South African cases indicate, regime admission of the depth and breadth of challenger support often comes only after years of violent struggle empirically establish the impossibility of repressing the problem at an acceptable cost. Proposition 1. Conciliatory strategies increase in relevance as the base of support for the challenger group expands. 2. The ideological character of the challenger group. The nature of the challenger's ideology affects the choice of a conciliatory strategy, affecting whether one seeks the transformation or the disintegration of the challenger movement, or some mix. See above. We expect that groups desiring the total destruction of the established order, nihilists, or its complete replacement would resist efforts to transform them into more moderate political partners. Under these circumstances, conciliatory tactics, if used, would be shaped by a strategy to promote the disintegration of the challenger group. In a related vein, Bruce Hoffman notes some significant differences between secular and religious-based ideologies. He argues that religiously motivated challengers are more likely to view their struggle in totalistic terms, consider violence as a sacramental act, and resist utilitarian calculations in their political decision-making. In contrast, a more secular desire for greater autonomy within the established political community, or even independence from it, when this devolution does not threaten the survival of the existing state, for example, the aspirations for independence by a colony, offers greater promise for a conciliatory strategy of transformation. Members of a challenger movement may hold their ideological positions neither consistently nor sincerely. Extremist rhetoric may obscure possibilities for compromise, and rejectionist leadership may change their attitudes over years of fruitless struggle. Lack of sincerity opens possibilities for political transformation. Lack of consistency creates openings to promote disintegration through defections. Proposition 2. Sincerely held totalistic and exclusionist ideologies preclude using conciliation to encourage the transformation of the challenger group. Corollary 1. Insincerely held ideologies may open possibilities to promote transformation. Corollary 2. Inconsistently held ideologies open possibilities to promote disintegration. 3. The characteristics of challenger organization. Kent Utz argues that other internal factors and dynamics, in addition to their ideological goals, affect challenger groups and the types of demands they make. Among these, he includes internal cohesion, competition with other groups, the size of the group, and the nature of the group's leadership. He suggests that sometimes these factors work to increase the group's political demands and the probability of violence. Alternatively, increasing size and competition combined with declining cohesion make it more difficult for the challenger to maintain a united front. Proposition 3. Increasingly complex challenger organizations create opportunities to pursue either their transformation and or disintegration. Another organizational factor worth weighing concerns the role of terrorist tactics in the overall Challenger strategy. As dissident groups increase their base of support and expand their repertoire of resistance, the relative significance of terrorism should diminish, while other avenues to pursue their objectives expand. By rewarding nonviolent expressions of dissent, a regime may encourage the abandonment of terrorism. Proposition 4. The increasing significance of non-terrorist tactics in the overall strategy of the challenger creates opportunities to encourage their transformation. 4. The political context of negotiations and conciliation. Any regime contemplating a conciliatory strategy must calculate not only the direct costs of compromise and the subsequent risk that terrorism on the part of others might be encouraged, they also must consider how concessions might provoke their own base of support. What may be gained in diminished violence from the challengers may be lost through new violence from the now disaffected members of the establishment. Even if increased establishment violence does not offset declines in challenger violence, a regime may encounter institutions and political constraints when attempting to make a deal with previous adversaries. Proposition 5. The more substantive the concessions proposed by the regime, the greater will be the institutional and political resistance to a strategy of accommodation. Clearly, more moderate challengers face equivalent risks from the more radical elements in their coalition, who may intensify both their attacks on the regime and add attacks on the moderates to their repertoire. Both the Palestinian and the South African cases give evidence of this commonly recognized problem. Again, widespread weariness with a fruitless struggle often works to reduce these risks. Proposition 6. Conciliatory strategies to encourage either the transformation of the challenger movement or the defection of its more moderate elements will tend to increase terrorist violence from remaining radicals. Another contextual factor concerns the setting for the negotiations. Robert P. Clark, in a sensitive analysis of the Spanish government's attempted negotiations with Basque insurgents, identifies a variety of considerations that seem generally relevant. In addition to the complex political and cultural setting that affects the parties attempting a negotiated settlement, Clark notes that the timing of a ceasefire often presents a roadblock. The possibilities range from the likely regime position of first truce, then talks, through truce begins when talks begin, to the more extreme dissident position of first concessions, then truce. A third area of dispute involves the definition of the agenda, especially those issues defined as technical and resolved promptly, and those considered political and thus more difficult to negotiate and often postponed. Proposition 7. Expect conciliatory efforts to be frustrated by the conflict between the challenger's desire to expand the agenda and the regime's desire to narrow it. 5. Conclusion. Conventional wisdom suggests that we should never bargain with terrorists. This preference for coercive and repressive responses rests more on rhetorical than on analytical characterizations of the problem of terrorism. If we consider terrorism as one possible tactic available to a challenger group engaged in a political struggle, we push the question of response back into the political context where it belongs. We argue that two major models of this context, the war model and the rational actor model, not only fail to preclude conciliatory strategies, they actually incorporate them. We note that conciliatory strategies have been used, sometimes with considerable success. We outline some of the strategic considerations that must be weighed in determining the appropriateness of negotiations and concessions. Clearly, policymakers will find it difficult to make these types of determinations, but the preference for repression fails to free them from equivalent analytical demands. Ill-considered repression runs as many risks as ill-considered concessions. In any case, repressive and conciliatory responses need not be seen as mutually exclusive. Rather, they are likely to be complementary parts of an overall strategy, particularly once we recognize time as a factor. Thus, the negative effects of immediate concessions may be offset by increased defensive or repressive measures. The negative effects of immediate repression may be offset by a long-term strategy of concessions. Moreover, a regime can always try to moderate some and repress the rest. We identify a number of tactical factors that might affect the choice of conciliatory strategies. These propositions represent not conclusions, but plausible propositions for future research. A further question for exploration concerns the impact of regime type on the selection of response to terrorism, whether conciliatory or repressive. Generally, commentators assume constitutional and political restraints limit the range of repressive responses available to democratic regimes. Perhaps the same institutional context also serves to limit the range of possible conciliation. For example, in a pluralist system, veto groups might stymie significant concessions as well as significant repression. Alternatively, we might expect that the key variable involves less the form of the regime than the essential strength of its political foundations. Weak states, whether formally democratic or authoritarian, will be both more vulnerable to terrorism and vacillating in their responses. In this regard, we note an interesting relation between repressive and conciliatory response in the context of a democracy. Those who advocate repression generally emphasize democracy's weaknesses, the relative vulnerability of open societies, the irresponsible behavior of a free press, the resistance of democratic citizens to necessary measures of coercive control, the shackling of effective repression by considerations of judicial due process, and so forth. Those who suggest the possibility of conciliation tend to emphasize democratic strengths: representativeness, responsiveness, willingness to compromise, and commitment to the rule of law. Those who ignore democracy's weaknesses are naive. Those who ignore democracy's strengths are as dangerous as the threats they presume to counter.